Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and it is February the 16th on the East Coast, still February 15th on the West Coast. And I want to welcome everyone from all over the world who's listening. The numbers seem to be increasing every day, and of course I'm grateful for that. Also grateful for the many emails that I get from the listeners. Sometimes there are some questions regarding the topics that we discuss, and some people have indicated that they have been able to overcome some of their fear, so we're grateful for that. This isn't about fear-mongering, it's about facing some very hard-to-grasp realities. Sometimes I like to call it mind-bending. We're dealing with topics that certainly are mind-bending, and to come to grips with new realities that have been really going on right under our noses for many, many years is a bit difficult, to say the least, for some. As you learn about these things, keep in mind that you always have the prerogative to do your own research and try to find supporting information one way or the other. Your beliefs are what they are. Our intention is to bring knowledge to you, and that's what we strive to do on Evident Footprints. We're going to do that with our guest tonight in a moment. Before I introduce him, I want to backtrack a little bit to 1995. There was a conference held in the state of Colorado. I believe it was in Denver, and a fairly young man in the middle of his business career was giving a talk to a large number of people, and the information that he disclosed was quite shocking. He had been working for the government, and actually several governments around the world, as a geologist. And we could say he was a geomechanical engineer or a geological engineer. He understood rock formations. He understood how to remove large amounts of stone from the ground, not just tunneling, but explosions and then excavations to build what turned out to be underground bases. At the time, he said he had already been involved in building 134 such underground bases in various countries around the world, though the majority that he had built had been in the United States alone. And he began talking about some very, very strange stories. He talked about an order for 186,000 cattle cars, and these were outfitted with 143 sets of shackles, and these shackles were to be used for humans. He described how some of these cattle cars had been outfitted with guillotines at one end of the car. And, of course, everyone who has studied European history knows about the guillotines. Now, recent information has come out that some 20,000 of these cattle cars had been ordered from China. Now that we know China can deliver the goods, evidently 186,000 were not enough, and they had to order another 20,000 of these cattle cars, again, fitting 143 people into shackles, and having not just China, but also France manufacturing guillotines for these cars. These cars have been seen in the vicinity of a train what is being called a repair station in the city of Indianapolis, Indiana. They've seen smokestacks at this facility, and the facility's not really being used to fix trains. But it looks as though it's going to evolve into some sort of a crematorium if these psychopaths get their way and get their New World Order established. They'll be rounding Americans and probably even some illegal aliens sneaking into the country by the millions into these cars and taken into these extermination camps, we can call them. They've been building concentration camps, and this gentleman who I just referred to, who talked about the 134 bases that he worked on, and these are underground bases, he talked about the fact that there were hundreds of concentration camps being built around the United States. In fact, today there are some 800. Now, in addition to the underground bases, he spoke very knowledgeably about the fact that he had also worked in conjunction with the U.S. Air Force and a machine that was developed first at Los Alamos Labs and then manufactured by the RAND Corporation. And it was a nuclear tunneling machine. This machine has a boring element on it that's some 300 feet long. We're talking about the size of a football field. And they can tunnel with this nuclear-powered tunneling machine, they can tunnel up to 7 miles a day underground. Now, the machine doesn't have to dig up the dirt like you would see a bulldozer or some earth mover removing dirt in the old-fashioned way. It turns it to a very hard substance and a glass-like substance with smooth, finished walls. So they got this technique down to where they can interconnect these underground bases, and they have built train systems or shuttle systems, if you want to call them that, that travel at anywhere between Mach 2 and Mach 3. So they're breaking the sound barrier with these trains, and they have shuttled congressmen and senators across the country. Now the congressmen have been asked, some have been asked about these tunnels, and they say, well, these tunnels are for safe transportation, but we know that they connect the underground bases. And what's interesting about the bases is who is at the bases working and who's working together. Now, this man in 1995 gave a couple of talks, and in 1996 he gave his last talk. He was found strangled in his house. And this after having been shot with a laser-type weapon at the Dulce base. In fact, there was what was known as the Dulce battle that occurred back in 1979, and he had sustained a chest injury, literally had a hole blown through his lung from a frontal attack with one of these weapons. And he described gray aliens and reptilians in the base in Dulce, New Mexico. Coincidentally, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cattle that have been mutilated over the years, body parts and fluids drained without a drop of blood. Linda Moulton Howe has done extensive research and reporting on this topic, so this is not a new topic, and it's something that is a phenomenon that's noticed by farmers and ranchers around the world. And despite the fact that they want to blame all of the incidents of UFO sightings, flying saucer sightings, alien abductions, cattle mutilations, and all the other phenomena that go with it, they still want to tell us that it's crash dummies, weather balloons, and swamp gas. So tonight we're going to bring our guest on. He's somewhat knowledgeable about these things, and he's certainly knowledgeable about the technologies that we're going to be talking about. And he's our weekly guest, author, scientist, inventor, lecturer, and teacher, and also a good friend, and hopefully becoming your friend, here on Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, how are you this evening?
I'm good, Don. How are you?
Oh, I'm just feeling my oats tonight. You know, I hate talking about some of these topics because they're just so dark. But I feel that we have a responsibility to talk about these things because we're getting subtle hints through the media, particularly through the movies they're showing on TV, that they have something planned. I just smell a rat, and I felt that we should talk about this tonight. I've been feeling this all week. So I hope you don't mind going into these topics.
No, I don't mind at all. As a matter of fact, I agree with you. I think that they've had things planned for quite some time. And by the way, I am familiar with the boxcar situation that that you had mentioned. As a matter of fact, a number of years ago, as you know from reading one of my earlier books, I'm quite a railroad buff,
mm-hmm.
and I noticed on one of my trips back to New Jersey that one of the stockyards out there has some very unusual-looking cars in there, quite a few of them, actually, on sidings, and I was told that they were for carrying automobiles, but they have a lot of breathing holes in them, and they look incredibly suspicious for the purpose that was quoted. And so I wouldn't be surprised if I was looking at some of the things you're talking about.
Now, I don't know if you saw any guillotines, but had you, maybe that those were for the chopped-down versions of the automobiles.
Well, I didn't look inside, so it's hard to say what was in there, but no, I didn't see any guillotines. But, you know, it's really amazing. I don't have anything personally against the French, but, you know, you keep on hearing these stories about the animosity that's building between the U.S. government and the French. And considering that, I think it's almost humorous that they would entertain a contract to provide 120,000 guillotines to the United States without even asking what the hell they were for. But
well, I'm sure they know what they're for. Obviously, anyone making it would have to know. They knew what they were for when they first invented it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I don't think the use has changed.
Yes. Well, you know, to some, this is a very frightening story. It just goes to show how insane some of these people have become. This has been going on for quite some time now. If I recall that the order for these cars went out in the mid-1980s. So we're talking about over 20 years ago. They've had 20 years to make all these cars. And I've seen the type of car that Phil Schneider described. And I've done a lot of reading, and I've actually seen his lectures. They were videotaped. They weren't the best recordings available at the time. But you can hear the man's voice, you can see him, and you can see his presentation, some of the documentation and maps and those things that he has. And he talked about his duty to explain to the people that this was real. And he talked about how much money the Department of Defense was operating on and how much extra money they had. And he felt that no one in office was really fessing up and telling the truth to the people so that we should know that this is actually going on. So, you know, my hat is off to him. I know that he is in a better place. The man really suffered for a long time from the injuries he had. You can imagine what it would be like to be struck with a radioactive weapon and have a hole go through your body and basically not get any real support from the very people that sent you down there. It was as though he had been intentionally sent sent down into this base, when he described the work he was doing at the Dulce base, it was to expand and possibly add an annex to the building. Now, that base at the time had 7 stories underground, or we could say at least 6. In other words, the first level was the ground level, but then the floors went down. And the word from all the research that had been done there, including an interview that Branton did with the security, head of security there at the base, the bottom 3 bases, or floors, or levels number 5, 6, and 7, were occupied by aliens. And I don't mean people sneaking over the border. And there was the most sadistic genetic research going on there that you could imagine. And they had a cover story that these people were mentally ill and they were being detained for research purposes, that they could determine if they could come up with a cure for their illness, where in reality what they were doing was all kinds of genetic experimentation on them. And the way this security guard described these people, he had seen some horrific things, and they were begging to be released. Now, it's interesting how many people annually turn up missing from Dulce, New Mexico, and the surrounding areas, yet nothing's ever done about it. And there are, of course, numerous sightings there. And it's not the only base, but it seems to have a lot of sadistic research going on there, as now many of the bases do. But throughout its history, it's been one of the most sinister and darkest of all the bases.
And well, it's interesting you should mention that.
Go ahead, Jim.
I thought it was interesting that you should mention that. As you know, I was introduced to a lot of this material a number of years back when I first allied myself with Gene Carini in Connecticut, and that was in the mid-60s, actually. And even then, I heard stories of a very similar nature. Of course, you didn't hear as many of them as you do today. But last week on the show, when we had the communications problem on your end, I tried to give a little background on the origin of a lot of this information, which originally was conceived to be myth, as you know. And, of course, tunnel systems are not new either. The ancient world had a huge number of tunnels, and interestingly enough, they were made in a similar fashion because they still have the glazed glass walls on some of the ones that are discovered under the Andes and other parts of the world. But getting back to the point that I wanted to make, Carini was telling me about these Deros that are supposedly reptilian beings that live underground in some of these cities. And there was a fellow by the name of Richard Shaver who wrote a book about it back in the 40s, I think it was, late 40s. And one of the things that came to my attention during that time period was a report that came out in one of those magazines that follows all this kind of stuff about a, and it's interesting because it was in either Western Arizona or New Mexico, I'm sorry, Eastern Arizona or New Mexico, that this event took place, but two cops, the state troopers, had pulled in for a cup of coffee around 3 o'clock in the morning. And as you know, out west there's a lot of little sleepy towns that have the main highway go right through them. And while they were just coming out of the diner, this semi went blasting through town at about 80 miles an hour out into the desert, and had never slowed down or anything. So they got in their car and pursued this guy and pulled the van over. And turned out it was a refrigerated van, and they noticed that the guy was very nervous, They asked to see his manifest, and I guess he showed them something. And then they insisted on breaking the seals and looking inside. And there were several hundred human bodies with no hands, no feet, no heads in this refrigerated van, and they were completely dressed out, just like you would dress out a side of beef. And, you know, I remember discussing this with Carini, and he said, well, don't, he said, it's not that much of a surprise. He said, the reptilians have a real appetite for human flesh. And he said, haven't you ever wondered where all the people go that disappear every year? And that was back in, I think it was 67. So it's interesting that you bring this up, because apparently nothing has changed. It's only gotten worse.
That's correct.
And it's interesting, too, that I mentioned this on the show also last week, that early conceptions of hell and demons always fantasized about creatures with horns and large gaping mouths and scaly bodies and claws and tails and things of that sort, which really has a reptilian ring to it. And the fact that Hades was originally considered an underground place, even in the story of Dante's Inferno, there's an allusion to the fact that you can walk into the midst of hell through a tunnel system, is all very interesting, because it seems to indicate that this phenomenon has been going on for quite some time. It's not anything new. And I think that the fact that you can now tie some of this so-called legend material into the present-day political scene is a very scary thing indeed.
Oh,
and of course,
yes.
You have...
I can guarantee you we can tie it into the present-day political scene. Now, there are tunnels, you know, for the listeners out there, you can Google Dulce, just D-U-L-C, comma, N-M for New Mexico, and the first article you will come to is one describing this underground tunneling machine, this nuclear-powered tunneling device that was manufactured by the RAND Corporation after Los Alamos Labs researched the technology, and it was given to the Department of the Air Force. Now, what's interesting is after they build these underground bases, and you may know this also, or you may have heard this, Jim, please verify this one way or the other, the Department of the Navy handles the supervision of what goes on in these underground bases and these underground tunnels. I find this crazy, but this is how they compartmentalize things, because you would assume the Navy would be at sea. Now, of course, quite possibly, when you go deep enough into the earth, you're going to find water. So I guess they figure they better have the Navy there just in case. But what's really an anomaly and very ironic is that the tunneling machine has the logo for the U.S. Air Force on it. And they're not above ground. They're going into the ground. This is, now they could say, well, you know, we're hiding our airplanes down there, so it has to be the Air Force. I mean, they don't want us to know this is going on, but the information is out there and it's on the web and it can be seen. In the very first link under Dulce, or possibly the second link. Maybe I misspoke, because I think the first one has a Google map for the town. So, but the very first serious link is a very lengthy article describing investigations that went on by state highway patrolmen, the sightings of the ships, the cattle mutilations, and these anomalies occurring. Now, had you heard any of this information, you know, about these tunneling machines, or the extent to which they're used, and who actually has priority over these programs?
No, not in those days I didn't, but more recently, when I was more interested in the following the money trail, you might say. I had discussions about that sort of thing with numerous people, and you know, one of the things that they might very well do is break up the expenditures for these vast projects between the different groups of the armed forces, just so that there wouldn't be an obviously huge expenditure associated with only one facet of the military. You know, whether it makes any sense or not is another story. Most of the stuff they do doesn't make any sense to us anyway.
Well,
but the idea that the Navy is involved is really not that much of a surprise. I've driven all around the country on various missions and whatnot, and I have seen Navy facilities in the most ungodly places you could ever imagine. I've seen them out in the desert. I've seen them in the middle of our country where they're nowhere near any oceans. You know, great big signs there, too, you know, U.S. Navy communications network, U.S. Navy monitoring system, you know, whatever the heck it's supposed to be doing. Don't forget, too, that there are now in use enormous communication grids that use ultra-low frequency signals which propagate through the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And they are used to communicate with submarines in the ocean. But the transmitters and the antenna grids are placed in huge vacant areas because they take up like a whole square mile just for one antenna. And a lot of times they'll do that in some place like the plain states or desert areas and stuff like this. So even though they appear to be completely out of place, they actually have facilities that they can talk to submarines anywhere in the world by transmitting these ultra-low frequency signals through the Earth itself. Not too far distant an idea from what Tesla was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the intelligence agencies are actually funneling all of their information through the Navy, and the Navy really controls much of the space program. It's you know, the naval intelligence handles the issues such as UFO sightings. Everyone thinks it would be the Air Force because we're dealing with flying craft. And it may be very possibly because these craft also come out of the ocean and go in and out of the ocean. To find a logical explanation is probably ridiculous. It's more that they just like to hide things where a person is really not going to expect to find them.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that.
Now,
but it's interesting you mentioned about them going in and out of the oceans. That's another thing, too, that's you know, within my scope of experience. You know that I used to lecture for Ivan Sanderson years ago, and he wrote a very famous book called Uninvited Visitors. And in that book there, he had numerous case histories, very well documented in most cases, where craft were seen emerging from lakes or emerging from the sea or plunging into large bodies of water. And sometimes even floating above the water and pumping water into their vehicles.
Yes. Well, I've heard some funny stories something along that line, but actually on land. Maybe we'll go into it sometime. It'll crack you up. It's actually funnier than your Walter Cronkite story. So,
well, that's good. Love to hear it.
Yeah, at the appropriate time we'll go into it. But this is a phenomenon that people describe seeing when they're on the beach, for instance, in Florida. It's seen, and I would suspect that there's an offshore in the ocean underground base, and these ships can just go in and out. No one would really suspect that would even happen, because we our thinking is not as such. we think a submarine is the only thing that can go underwater, and that there's no way a flying object could go in and out of the water like that. But it's just another medium for these ships. It's probably much simpler than going through space in many ways, not just in terms of physics, but in terms of the performance of the vehicles and the stresses that they undergo.
Well, once you have control over gravitational forces, you can do a lot of amazing things. You know, if a ship like that was to plunge into the ocean, it would actually not even get wet. It would just literally be surrounded by a bubble of space in which there was no water. And I always find it amusing to contemplate that issue, because the Navy has, in the silent service, the submarine service, they have an expression when they want to dive a ship, and they say, make a hole. Well, a submarine makes a hole by virtue of its presence being underwater, but a UFO really makes a hole. So it's an interesting concept to muse upon.
Yes. Now, since we're speaking about ships, I want to let you know and let the listeners know that I am in the process of posting some really awesome photos of some Nazi flying saucers on my photo page on at directlightproductions.com. Now, I have not begun posting those yet, but before the end of the weekend, they will be up on the site for your perusal, and they will be downloadable as well. And you're going to have to look at these photos, because we have the backup documentation, the drawings that were done when these things were invented. There is German descriptions, and I speak and read and write German, and I can tell you it's German, and they're describing the capabilities of these craft and some of the technical issues on some of the drawings. They're sort of, you know, they're not exactly patent papers, but I would be interested to see your reaction to these, Jim, in case you haven't seen any of these. Now, one of my guest hosts, or I should say one of my guests, sometimes he's just about a host too, has been kind enough to send me some pictures from his collection, and I'm going to be combining the pictures he has with the ones I've got, and they're pretty mind-blowing to look at when you consider that these were in existence in the 1940s. And of course, you know, it just further proves the propaganda that we've been through, that there, you know, these things don't exist, but the Germans had them. Now they could try to spin the story and say, well, all the ones that we're seeing now are the ones that the Germans made. But these craft had gun turrets on the top and halfway down, near where a normal saucer would have a porthole for viewing the panorama, and even on the bottom of the ships, they had these gun turrets, and multiple turrets. We're not just talking about a couple. These things were going to be used for war, and quite possibly could have been, but it's evident that they were not built for interstellar travel. You could see rivet holes and the seams of the craft. It wasn't built anything, let's say, that would give you the performance that one would think that these craft could achieve. There were obvious limitations, is what I'm saying.
Well, I have seen photographs of some of these deals, and the most shocking thing about it is to see a UFO or a vehicle that resembles what we call a UFO landing on the tarmac, and then having a swastika on the side of it and a German officer standing next to it.
Yeah,
that's an amazing combination when you see the pictures.
Yes,
but it doesn't surprise me that they had the technology so much, It would just be interesting to know, you know, where it truly derived from, and, you know, where it has been all this time. But I think probably it has had more than one source. We've already explored on several shows, you know, the fact that Tesla's material was stolen when he was murdered. We also have talked about the investigations of Schoberger into the forces of gravity, and he was a German. And I'm sure there were others. So, you know, this is not a total surprise. And also the fact that the CIA and other agencies within the heart of our government are actually formed by ex-Nazis after the war, it just seems to all fit together, you know. They've been a very active little bunch.
Well, I don't think they ever stopped being Nazis, did they?
I'm
acknowledging the fact that you said ex-Nazis. So, you know,
you're probably right. They just changed uniform, but they're still Nazis.
Yes.
Once a Nazi, always a Nazi.
Jawohl, mein Herr. Also, there's another anomaly with this whole thing too, and that there has been repeated revelations from a variety of sources that the Germans had quite possibly traveled to Mars at some time. Now, when this would have occurred is in question. But doubting it is not a big stretch, or really even a consideration, on the basis of how many different people who claim to have been involved in some covert program to go up to Mars. And the information has been coming out that we've been up there since 1962, or 7 years prior to any announcement about the moon. In other words, they didn't want us to know they could go to Mars, so they wanted to sell us on the idea that they were trying to get to the moon. And as I understand it, many of the moon missions were a lot more disastrous than what they led on. Were you ever told anything about that, by Gene Carini?
No, as you probably realize, that my involvement with Carini was actually before the first moon episode, which I think was in 69, if I remember correctly. But we did talk an awful lot about the fact that the technology to get into space was in existence for a long time, and why was it that rockets were still being advocated as the best means for escaping the gravity of Earth. And, you know, it's the same old story. I think it comes down to deception. You know, if the public doesn't know what you have, don't tell them. And so, you know, they raise all these monies for various space efforts, and once the cash is in hand, you don't know really how much it costs to do this or that and where the money really goes. So maybe the entire Apollo program, for instance, was a deception to keep you focused on us breaking our backs to get to the moon when, in fact, we were already on Mars. But what's really interesting, though, of all of the planets and other celestial bodies that we could go to, I think it's fantastic that Mars would be the one that they would focus on, because our own heritage tells us, if you read the ancient stuff, that Mars was once inhabited and that there was commerce between Earth and Mars. And so it's very interesting that that they would go there. I would just love to know what the heck they found there, you know. That would really be worth knowing.
I was going to make a wisecrack and say I would venture to guess it was the Mars bar, but
But I know I've always had
Go ahead.
The delay here is killing us.
Yes,
I've always had a particular fascination for Mars, you know, always wanted to go there when I was young and starry-eyed, so to speak. But if they have gone there, it's a pity that they're so secretive about it all, because it would really be an amazing thing to know what's going on for real. And, of course, it would expand the consciousness of all humans to be informed that not only had we returned to Mars, but that we had found remnants of earlier human occupation and previous civilizations. I think that would just be absolute headline news.
Yes. Well, on a previous show, and I think this was a couple of weeks ago, you and I talked about the fact that Bill Ryan and Kerry Cassidy videotaped an interview with psychic David Wilcock, and David has also intuited that there's something going on up there on Mars, and then they got a hold of Richard Hoagland, and Hoagland gave them something like a two-and-a-half-hour interview showing extensive documentation about the new photos that they have from Mars and the new information that's being leaked out of NASA, not intentionally by NASA itself, but they're just sort of connecting the dots and arriving at some conclusions that there is much more than a couple of shadows, we'll say. That they like to explain away when we see something, but I mean the lies are so pervasive that you can't even expect the government to admit it. Just discount that. It's just like the vote fraud. You know, don't expect them to admit that it's a crooked election. And so we have the same issue here. Nonetheless, we have an individual, and then via our rise in consciousness, we have a collective responsibility to talk about these things and come to some conclusions as to what can be done. Because there's definitely an agenda here, Jim. Why would, and just consider this for a moment, and I'm going to let you run with this. I recall the State of the Onion speech a couple of weeks ago, as I call it. And I've been peeling the layers back on that speech. That's why I call it the State of the Onion address. And we were, again, fear-mongered with this ruse about the terrorists, the big bad terrorists want to come here and get us. And that, you know, we have to be in these countries, we have to create wars to go over there to spread democracy. And if the democracy that we have is what they're spreading, we can tell those people, just tell them no thanks, or thanks but no thanks. So with this democracy that we have, and this is the point I want to make, why the underground bases, why the underground tunnels, why all the secrecy? If there is no threat, I mean, to me, it's kind of stupid to build underground tunnels and give the terrorists a way to get underneath our cities, or to move undetected from city to city. Now, what are they going to say? Oh, we have that covered. Well, they can't even cover the borders. You're going to tell me that they're going to cover thousands of miles of underground tunnels? I don't think so. So the big question is, what is the purpose of this? This is not a democratic function, and it's not a Republican function, for that matter. It, in fact, it doesn't even sound human to me.
Any well, comment? remember the old definition about how do you identify a democracy? And might shed some light on it. So the analogy that's given is that five wolves invite a sheep to dinner, and then they all cast votes on who's going to be eaten. So, you know, this brings us back to the exact same situation. You know, democracy is a form of mobocracy. And that once you realize that, then you're forced to ask the question, well, what constitutes the mob? Now, you know,
yeah.
we normally think about it as, crime figures, whether they happen to be government employees or not. We usually think of them as being human. But, supposing that there's validity to the idea that alien presence have been here for centuries controlling issues from behind the scenes. It kind of reminds you of the guy behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. They have an advanced technology, they use it for their own benefit, and they're preparing the planet for something. And eating a lot of humans in the interim. It's not altogether impossible to consider this. It's just a little bit scary, perhaps, for most people, because, when you reach our age, you hope the boogeyman has been retired. And now we find out that they're in the White House and every place else. So it's kind of unnerving, but it's worth thinking about because normal explanations don't carry water, as you know.
That's true. Now there's an interesting. You're going to flip when you see the photos that I'm going to be posting on my site. I already have one which is quite interesting, and I've had a number of people ask me what this figure is, and I have a horned skull on my news page. When you click on news, when you go to directlightproductions.com and click on news at the top of the page, the index page on the news page actually has this photograph there. In fact, Michael Anthony sent me that photograph, and he sent me one that has an explanation of the background of this thing. And it was discovered in Pennsylvania, of all places. Now, we're told these stories about dinosaurs, and what's interesting about the skull is that the narration that accompanies the photograph describes it as a human skull, as if humans had horns at one time. Now, when did that enter archaeology or anthropology? I don't recall hearing about horned humans when I was learning this stuff. We talked about...
Well, me neither.
You neither, right?
No, well, I've heard about horny humans, but not horned humans.
Jim, you're on a roll tonight. And I have to watch what words I use here because that could be taken the wrong way. I mean, it looks demonic. Now, the story behind that skull, for anyone that went to my website and has seen that there, it says, human skulls with horns were discovered in a burial mound at Sayre, Bradford County, Pennsylvania, in the 1880s. Horny projections extended 2 inches above the eyebrows, and the skeletons were 7 feet tall, but other than that, were anatomically normal. So you had these prehistoric basketball players, basically, is what they're saying, with horns on their head. I don't recall much history about 7 foot beings, in America back in that time either. I mean, they're saying, we're getting taller now, and it's probably because of all the hormones they put in all the foods, especially milk. Which would stimulate abnormal growth, in the youth. And then it could be also just genetic experimentation that's causing that to happen. However, the fact that this is attributed to a human where the eye sockets look like they would support eyes about the size of a tennis ball. Now, that's on my website, but I've got one, Jim, that if you haven't seen it, it's from the waist up to the head, in other words, with including arms, it looks very human. It's got a rib cage, it's got eyes, nose, mouth, ears, the whole nine yards, chin, cheeks, you know, it looks like a human. And the lower half from, and I'm calling it the waist with reservation, but let's say it would be where one's waist would begin on the average torso. And there were no legs on this being. The tail end of the being is a crocodile. And they're finding these animals along the beach in a particular area of the world. And when I post that picture, the whole story will be there with it. You have to see this thing. It's mind-blowing. And they say that they found something like 3,500 of these are living there in this area. Now, you've got these half human, half crocodile creatures on the beach, and the authorities in the area were trying to decide if they should close the beach down for safety or just put more people on guard. the mindlessness, I don't know. Would you just say, well, you know, we ought to consider closing the beach down, or maybe we'll just put some guards up here? I mean, it's half human and crocodile. That doesn't seem to sink in.
Well, the only bell that rings for me, because I'm not even going to comment on the stupidity of local municipalities when it comes to the stories you hear about the beaches. The mere fact that there are crocodilian creatures roaming around on the beach only adds to the confusion. But the thing that strikes me, of course, is where are these creatures coming from? And what's really interesting, of course, is that there are numerous legends going way back in history which describe the fact that there was a time when gene splicing was routinely done between humans and other type animals. And some of this information has survived in mythology. As you know, we have centaurs, we have pans, we have griffins, we have all kinds of critters that seem to have emerged as a result of this type of activity. But more recently, we already know that cloning is going on. If they talk about cloning and the production of chimerons when they release some of these stories from research institutes for the public to muse upon, you can bet your bottom dollar that what they allow to be printed in the newspaper represents only 1/1,000th of what's probably going on behind the scenes. And whether that type of activity is sponsored solely by earthbound scientists, or whether there's some influence from an extraterrestrial source, has yet to be determined. But it's interesting that these particular creatures would share reptilian features instead of another mammal type thing. We already know that there's been crossbreeding experiments done with humans and humanoid type species like the Greys. That's been reported on since the 40s, possibly mm-hmm. earlier.
Yeah.
But maybe this latest crop of critters is the result of attempts to merge reptilian genetics with human genetics. Sounds fishy anyway, that's for sure.
Well, the description of this event, in fact, I'll tell you this, that it's supposedly occurred on Safania Beach. And
Where is Safania Beach?
Well, there's a reference to Egypt, so we're going to say this is somewhere possibly along the Nile River or off the coast of the Nile. And remember, you know, in past shows, we talked about the Syrian-Egyptian connection going back thousands of years ago, and that the Syrians introduced a lot of technology to the Egyptians and basically furnished monatomic gold to the pharaoh so that they could keep him a notch above the rest of the people in his mental acuity. And then there was the worship of the reptiles there that, I don't want to say legend, I mean, this is the history that that they had given shelter to reptiles, and reptiles were actually considered to be revered as holy or sacred critters, much like the cows are in certain parts of India.
Right.
But the caption, and it's a shame you can't see this, but I'll have it up on the site and for your next show, and we'll talk about this. It says, Aramco Security and Industrial Security Force, or ISF, are debating as to whether to issue a warning, close the beach, or do nothing, and assist in manpower control. Investigation resulted that there are more than 3,500 of these kind of human animal in the Tanajib area. It is 25 years since last time it was seen in the Tanajib area. And then this is written in Arabic underneath this caption. And this caption was written later in the day. It describes it as having been found that day. I mean, this thing is lifting its head up and looking at something out in front of itself. It's got hair on its head too, by the way. You know, it's a little bit of a receding hairline for such a young critter, but you can see the ribs. It's got arms and hands and eyes and a nose and a mouth and ears. I mean, it's half human and half crocodile. No doubt about it. I was going to say there's a correlation to what has been seen in these underground bases as well. These types of animals or these types of creatures have been seen, and maybe even worse. You know, with four arms or eight legs. And I've heard multiple descriptions of this. Now, we could say, well, this is just insane. You know, this is more the same kind of disinformation and fear-mongering. But I'm just reporting the stories that I've heard, and they seem to be coming from lots of different places in cases that you can substantiate that there was an abduction and that what these unlikely victims reported is suspiciously like what the knowledgeable researchers have seen or found out. All yours, Jim.
Well, I don't really know what to say about it directly, but I can tell you one thing. Hollywood has always been on top of things in some way, shape, or form, whether it's by design or happenstance, when it comes to the ideas that are behind the stories they release as films. And what you're telling me is kind of interesting, because for the last 4 or 5 years now, there have been all kinds of films about what do they call them, mutants. They disguise some of these guys as superheroes, but still, you know, the concept is being put out there that there are things emerging in the race which are out of the ordinary, and the basic idea is that the normal compulsion would be to be concerned about this, but it seems like the spirit of the film is such, oh, don't worry, this is the way of things. They have super abilities. No doubt they'll be it'll be wonderful to have these guys aboard. So, you know, just lower your guard and embrace them as your fellow man, and all will be well, you know. But what's really behind all this would be incredible to find out. I mean, it's one thing if it's just Hollywood looking for something to make a movie about, and it's another thing if it's the tip of a secret iceberg that is definitely part of an agenda.
Yes. I'm hearing what you're saying. I'm going to be posting, and I'm definitely going to ask you to take a look at them. I should have them up tomorrow for sure. I'd like you to look at them, and when you next time you're on the show, we'll analyze some of this stuff. Now you're going to find it interesting because some of these artifacts that I'm going to post, for instance, some very unusual looking skulls. Are in a Peruvian museum right now. And I would suspect that they had been found in Peru. One of the skulls looks like the head of the monster in the movie Alien, the one that Sigourney Weaver starred in.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean, with the elongated cranium in the back.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's a spitting image of that. Now,
well, you know what's interesting? That's been, they've tried to pawn that off as the result of head binding, which used to be a popular undertaking in various cultures, particularly those in South America. Now, I have two things to say about that. First of all, head binding is generally done with a special board that goes on the back of the baby's skull, and then when they bind it, they use a flat cape-like material, which is, you know, made from some type of fabric, so they don't want to use ropes or cord, which would put grooves in the baby's skull.
Yeah.
And so when a child has had a head binding like that, there's a telltale signature due to the flatness of the back of the head. And so this is definitely not from that source. I have seen those skulls, and I can tell you that they are. First of all, there's at least three or four different types, and some of which, especially the pumpkin head, so-called, you could never get a shape like that from binding anything unless you grew your child in a deep sea helmet. I don't know how you would ever get a shape like that. The other thing is, we acknowledge the fact that there was skull binding or head binding practiced by a lot of these tribes. And interestingly enough, these brilliant anthropologists who investigate all this stuff never ask the question, well, what prompts somebody to distort the head of the child that they've just given birth to so that they can essentially grow up looking quite grotesque with respect to the rest of the tribe? What is it in honor of? What is it in reverence to? And, you know, that to me would be the most important question to ask. And, you know, maybe it's because they're trying to give the kid an edge in life at that time by giving him a skull that would make him look like he was related to an important creature that had some relationship to that tribe or some authority over that tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is the same old thing. We look at stuff and we just don't really consider the impact of what it means.
Yeah.
Most human beings do things for a reason, you know, and it makes sense to explore those reasons.
Well, the one you call the pumpkin head, I'm looking at that. I'm presuming that that's the one, the same skull, because it does look very much like a pumpkin head. What's interesting is the size of the orbitals in this thing. I mean, they're huge, and yet the skull protrudes to the side just equally as much, if not more. It's huge.
There's no way that you can bind a head that's going to increase the size of the eye sockets. You know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of stuff like that that's been floating around for hundreds of years, which is just swept under the rug. I mean, it's not even talked about. I can tell you story after story that I was told personally by Ivan Sanderson years ago when I worked with him, which undoubtedly sheds light on the attitude of the real authorities in this country when it comes to issues of this sort. The Smithsonian is notorious for sweeping evidence under the rug. If it doesn't conform with the traditional history that they want to expound upon, then it's done away with, or at least it's hidden from the general populace. You know, that's been done with many, many things. So the fact that these things are not openly investigated can only mean a couple of things, in my view. Either they already know all about it, and they keep it to themselves, or else they're 10 times more stupid than we give them credit for.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure which it is.
Well, before we close this show tonight, Jim, we're about out of time here. I wanted to bring up one that's coming to mind, and there may be some connection here. I suspect that at some time in the near future, if it's not already been discovered, we're going to find in the ice in Antarctica beings beginning in the range of 16 feet tall. And we're going to find these beings preserved because they're in a frozen state. And we're going to see that they have purple skin and these elongated craniums and this skull I'm looking at, this elongated cranium, you know the one I'm talking about, the one that looks like the movie. That's got to be a very large being. It's not going to be a dwarf running around with a head that size because it wouldn't be able to stand up just because of the weight and the angle of the skull. It moves backward at a 45-degree angle. The forehead is actually moving backward. There's nothing flat about the forehead other than it moves towards the rear. and it implies that that's a very tall being. When Admiral Byrd made his expedition, I think it was Byrd, wasn't it, that they sent to Antarctica?
Well, he actually went to both poles.
Yes, but the trip to the South Pole was very abrupt. It was hyped as something that was going to take months, and there was going to be all kinds of exploration. And I understand it was somewhere in a week, and they hightailed out of there really fast. They found something there that just scared the daylights out of them, and they had to come back, probably for fear of their lives. And I was just wondering if you had ever heard anything from any of your associates as to what might have been going on down there, or what might be going on down there.
Well, actually, I did. I was very interested in Byrd's original expedition, where he flew by dead reckoning, dead north, toward the North Pole. And then at a certain point, he ignored his instruments and just kept flying in the original direction and supposedly flew into the polar opening that exists somewhere up there. And he reported seeing land masses which were not on the maps, and he reported seeing forests where there are none, and reported seeing two suns at one point, one ahead of him and one behind him. And all these different things, including animal forms that he reported. And then, as far as I recall, the object of the deal was to see if there was a similar construction regarding the opening in the planet at the South Pole. And so they flew a similar mission down there. And then whatever happened down there didn't turn out the way they thought it was going to. But what was interesting about it was there was some kind of an opening at that end. What transpired after they flew in there, I don't know. But the interesting thing about it is if you check the chronology of that flight, it's a very short time after that when the government initiated, the world government initiated the International Geophysical Year. And at that point in time, despite the title of the undertaking, it's amazing that every nation on Earth hightailed it to the South Pole and set up bases there. And most of them are still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you. Something, they found something down there at that point in time, which is just another thing we don't know about. But you don't spend that kind of money and every nation on Earth go there for a vacation spot because it's 180 below zero when the wind blows down there and it's not a very pleasant place to live. And yet they go out of their way to go there. There must be a reason for it. Now, there was a lot of commotion also about the fact that the extreme cold was typical of the surrounding areas. But once you got into the depression, which led to the opening into the interior of the planet, that it was like a completely different territory. There was grass growing, there was a mild climate, and there was evidence of forests and stuff like that. And I did see pictures of ice-free areas in Antarctica that came from sources back in the 50s and 60s. So that was long before the global warming issue. And so it may very well be that that's what they were interested in exploring was the polar opening.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever it is, it's like everything else. We're told nothing.
We have a week to figure out what it is, so we have something to talk about next week.
Well, I don't think we've ever been out of sorts when it comes to something to talk about.
Oh, I'm just joking, but we'll see what we can come up with. This conversation has been interesting, and it's spurred us into a new area of research. We've just given them another reason to eavesdrop upon us. So.
Well, I've been openly discussing this stuff since my teens, you know, and I haven't been tormented by anything at this point. But of course, I never did it on the radio, so maybe
yeah.
That'll change things.
Oh, well, Jim, it's been a pleasure having you on again tonight, as usual. It's nice to compare information and discuss these possibilities. I have more I could add going way past our bedtime here, so and we don't want to lose our listening audience, but I want to thank you for being on the show, and you're going to be with us next Friday again, and in fact we want to let the listening audience know that you're going to be doing two shows in a row. You'll be on next Friday and then that following Monday, first show of the week. The next 2 weeks, we have a guest on the show every night, and we're going to be discussing a lot of very interesting things. We've got world-renowned authors. We've got some people coming on that are almost as famous as Jim Murray. So,
famous or infamous, Don?
Both, I guess. We're going to be talking about some of these subjects too, as well as we'll be talking about what's going on with the votes and politics and the government and the New World Order and healing and just about anything you can think of, and definitely some more ufology. So I'm looking forward to those shows, and you'll be on two of them, Jim, so that's good news. And I want to thank you for tonight and thank the listening audience, and wish everyone a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back next week, same place, same time. In the meantime, peace, love, and light, and have a very good night and a great weekend. Good night.